Welcome to Night Clerk Radio, episode 10, Hauntology. We're going to be looking at some of the philosophical, theoretical framework in which to explain why is Vaporwave? Why do we like it so much? What is appealing about it? And why this particular aesthetic? Of course, with me is my co-host, Burke.
Hey.
How you doing, Burke?
I'm good. I'm excited because, you know, this is our second topic episode. We previously discussed Plunderphonics. Mm-hmm. And as I was thinking about this episode, while Plunderphonics is probably more, air quotes, important to Vaporwave, I definitely think Hauntology is the more interesting topic of the two, personally.
Yeah, I mean, I agree because Plunderphonics explains sort of the how is it made? Like what the sort of like production techniques and like why, and also why it works for Vaporwave. But like Hauntology is sort of explaining why did this music of genre of music come to be? It turns out it's actually pretty obvious if you think about it. I don't know. At least to me, it seems like, oh yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. The more I think about it. So I guess we should start right at the beginning of like, what is Hauntology?
Probably good.
You probably did a little more show notes on this end than I did.
So oh, no.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. So Hauntology is a term coined by Derrida in 93 in his book Spectres of Marx, where everybody had kind of gone all end of history, Fukuyama, after the fall of the Soviet Union. And Derrida was very interested in how we connected with our memories, how we can feel disjointed from our own past, either one we lived in or didn't and have only heard about. Mm-hmm. So he sort of coined this term, specifically the haunt and Hauntology was referencing Marx, because it was like, well, Marx died a century ago and everyone in Europe is still obsessed with him. Mm-hmm. These ideas on either side just won't go away. But then I think, you know, it sort of languished for a while, but was really revived in the 2000s by music critics like Simon Reynolds and Mark Fisher, mm-hmm. who used it to refer to a specific kind of music coming out of the UK. And they really talked about how this music, so clearly tied to Vaporwave, is much more about invoking like cultural memory or identity through our media consumption. And that branched out into all these bands. So they were really focused on this UK label, Ghostbox, which I actually didn't look to see if it's still around, but they wrote about that a lot. And there were other bands like Baczynski and The Caretaker. I think you want to get into Low Boards of Canada, so we can talk about them later. And they just really looked at how these music genres produced meaning through their aesthetic, how they were actually produced in studio, and what they're trying to do with their audience. So that's really where we're headed today.
Mm-hmm. By the way, Ghostbox is still around. At least they have a website.
Great. That's awesome.
Yeah. So like the idea is we are kind of haunted by our own past. The first thing this, I guess, to really think about is, you know, one common aesthetic image in Vaporwave is Windows 95. The thing about Windows 95 is you can't talk about it anymore the way that is being talked about it right now. Like to talk about Windows 95 in 1995 is fundamentally different than talking about it in the year 2020. And you know, in a sense, think about, because in 1995 it was new, it was the next big thing, but in 25 years later, Windows 95 is of course an obsolete technology and wrapped up in nostalgia. So that's sort of one important aspect of Hauntology, is that, you know, even if you use you can never recreate a certain cultural moment in time, you know, no matter how much you want to. So by referring to the past, you're actually saying something different. You're not saying what Windows 95 meant back then. Now you're saying whenever you say Windows 95, you're talking about what it means right now. Mm-hmm. And that's why these sort of references to anachronistic, you know, obsolete technologies is so important to it, to Vaporwave, because Vaporwave is sort of us being haunted by our past and also futures that never existed, but were kind of promised to us.
In some sense, I was kind of thinking about that, because mm-hmm. there's sort of two versions of promised futures in a somewhat depressing way, is that there's the actual one that I think about of like, we're both in the US, so this is very US based politically, mm-hmm. but in terms of stuff like social programs, like healthcare, mm-hmm. education reform and affordability, like all this stuff that I actually wanted that I feel is in some sense lost or severely delayed. But then there's the other like retro future technology side of stuff of you know, where's my flying car? I was supposed to have a robot butler in my Mars colony mm-hmm. by now. But that's sort of interesting because it almost comes from media itself. There's no, at no point did a U.S. politician stand up and say, I will promise to the American people robot butlers and flying cars by 2005, right? It almost just became, we saw these things in sci-fi and in media and wanted them.
Mm-hmm.
And then sort of absorbed that into the culture where saying, where's my flying car became a joke, referencing that joke of where's my flying car.
The flying car aspect is sort of like implied because of capitalism will mean progress in science and technology and things will get better and cheaper forever. And that sort of was the implicit assumption about like pretty much every bit of fiction about the future is that things would get better and better, at least technologically speaking. And so it was inevitable that we would have flying cars. Now we've, especially, you know, you mentioned the end of history. Mm-hmm. Ever since the Soviet Union's over, the bad guys have been defeated. There's nothing to do but lay back and just have a great life. Things are going to get better and faster and cheaper forever.
That was totally the 90s vibe, right? You know, like the Clinton economy and all. We're just mm-hmm. chilling back and watching the numbers go up. And there's literally nothing to worry about.
I mean, there were problems, but there were problems that could be solved by personal choice. You know, environmentalism was a matter of recycling mm-hmm. and being conscious, and racism was a matter about personal action and responsibility and like being able to accept others for who they are. If all forms of bigotry, like the idea of systemic racism was not like something people were ready to accept in the 90s.
Yeah. I mean, it's easy now in social media, but back then, if you were a marginalized voice, it was very hard, mm-hmm. unless you were extremely bombastic or popular, mm-hmm. to make people realize all the problems. So it's sort of, you know, it's tongue in cheek talking about the Clinton era, because it was really just chill and hang back for a kind of a subset of the population, and everybody else still had the same shit going on.
So culturally, I think that's sort of the appeal of vaporwave. There's an interesting discussion to be had, I think, between the differences between synthwave and vaporwave. But I think, at least to me, the sort of most personal or the most the biggest difference between them is synthwave is we were promised a future that was cool and we want that. So we really love the 80s coolness. Then vaporwave is we were promised a future that was safe. All problems were problems of personal alienation. It was because we were latchkey kids and like we were going to be home alone, or like our friends didn't accept us, or we're going to have a job and an office, everything from being home alone to Fight Club. And that was as bad it was going to get. But like to a lot of people, that's, boy, that would have been great, wouldn't it have been? Like you weren't going to face the climate apocalypse. You weren't going to face political catastrophe and crisis after crisis. We're kind of, I think people who are interested in vaporwave are in some level both wanting and also pissed or anxious about it, that we weren't given that. We're given what we have right now.
No, I think saying the future that is safe is really great wording. I really like that because it is so different from the, like you said, synthwave outrun mm-hmm. kind of like, I'm just going to hop in my cool laser car and drive down the laser roads as laser palm trees mm-hmm. blow past without a worry. That is interesting. I like that phrasing a lot.
I mean, also if you look at it, like synthwave is definitely what I would call Mark Fisher's nostalgia mode and Ghost of My Life in the opening essay, which is sort of the manifesto, but kind of like summary. If you just had to read 30 pages of Mark Fisher, that would be the 30 pages I would recommend. He references Frederick Jameson. And so actually it's Frederick Jameson who references nostalgic mode, but Fisher applies it to music specifically. And so his reference is the Arctic Monkeys, which had a music video that was basically like almost identical of a earlier era of British pop music. And so his quote here, Jameson's nostalgia mode is better understood in terms of formal attachment to the techniques and formulas of the past, a consequence of a retreat from the modernist challenge of innovating cultural forms adequate to contemporary experience. So I bet you look good on the dance floor. If you look up the video for that, for the Arctic Monkeys, it looks like something that came out of the early 1980s. And he specifically mentions being broadcast on the old gray whistle test in 1980. So again, I'm not familiar with British pop culture from that era, but like if you look at it, it has a very specific retro look. It's very just like, let's make it look like they use sophisticated video editing and filters to make it look like that. It's staged like a garage band in like a community center, essentially. And synthwave is the same way. They unapologetically love the synthesizer techniques and technology of the 1980s, you know, the John Carpenters and every other action movie, you know, Commando, et cetera. And they want to replicate that. But if you look at Vaporwave isn't nostalgia mode in that sense, because they're distorting, they're using plunderphonic techniques. It's like taking that source material, taking that sort of era of music and then mutating it in a sense. Like there's a lot more experimental work being done, but you can't find vaporwave music that exists pre-2008 because no one took Diana Ross and slowed it down and made it music. Exactly. That's kind of, I think, the difference between synthwave and vaporwave, which again connects to Hauntology.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll include a link to that video in the show notes if other people want to check it out.
Yeah.
I think that definitely does capture, because Hauntology, and we'll talk about vaporwave and other genres on the show specifically, but like as a critical analysis tool, Hauntology applies to pretty much any form of media. Mm-hmm. You can probably do a hauntological reading of most stuff made in the past 20 or 30 years.
Yeah. In fact, Mark Fisher then mentions a movie called Body Heat, which was made in 1981, but it feels like it was made like as a 30s noir movie kind of. So yeah, like movies, TV, anything that was basically like, oh, it's like we made it using production techniques from 30 years ago, but now we just kind of updated it in a few ways.
Yeah, that'll give me a chance to shout out my favorite movie of all time, the 1993 classic, same year, Spectres of Marx. Interesting. Sneakers, which is a 93 computer caper, but basically with Robert Redford, and it's almost has the same energy as like a 70s post-Watergate spy thriller.
Yeah, 7 Days of the Condor kind of vibe.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So this is sort of endemic to pop culture in general, is it? Especially Mark Fisher basically says that this is because of capitalism is sort of feasting upon itself. Since the end of the Cold War, we've run out of new ideas. In fact, there aren't supposed to be new ideas because everything's supposed to be the same forever now.
That's right.
I mean, that might be a simplification, but that was kind of the vibe I was getting from my reading of Fisher.
No, I think that's right, because you want to make stuff that's easy to resell to people. Mm-hmm. People like their memories. And I think it's important to note that this really goes beyond, to me anyway, the normal, oh, it's just that 20, 30 year nostalgia cycle. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that's related. But when you talk about something like in the hauntological sense, there's a much deeper emotion evoked through the use of nostalgia in terms of really, really trying to pull people into a past, and often a past that never really existed.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, nostalgia mode is one thing, but like, again, vaporwave is doing something different. But for me, it was quite the experience to before times, I went to Australia to visit my partner, Maddie, and she was working at Fringe, which is a live performance festival, which they had thousands of shows spread over a month over different venues of like circus and stand up and, you know, theater, but they also had a lot of live music. All of this music, almost all of it, they were all cover acts. They were singing specifically very 90s and early 2000s stuff. There was an Amy Winehouse tribute show. It was regularly sold out. There was an entire band that just did a cappella covers of 90s pop music and early 2000s stuff, you know, the Backstreet Boys and NSYNC and Kiss from a Rose. And they're very talented singers. It was a very entertaining show, but like these were just packed with people that seeing that, and just like there were a few shows that offered original music, but they weren't nearly as popular. Usually they were in smaller venues, more experimental. So it all comes back to the question, why is vaporwave different than all of this, and why are we attracted to it?
So I think what's interesting is that while there's this very interesting large social analysis you can do, we're a music podcast. We talk about haunted genres of music. We've done it a lot so far. So I've sort of isolated ways that I think this really plays into how the music is produced. So one, which is the easiest because we've sort of already done it, is just the aesthetics, mm-hmm. right? Just the imagery, the iconography of something like vaporwave, that 80s, 90s, like you said, Windows 95, 80s style cars, 8 and 16-bit images and sounds, a big one is just formats that we used to consume media on that don't exist really anymore, like VHS, although you have a very nice VHS collection, which kind of is on brand for us, I suppose. But there's also worked into that, you know, activities. So we did a whole episode on Mallsoft, which is just about, wasn't it neat to used to be able to go to stores? Like, that's the general premise of the genre, is like, you used to be able to go to these halls of consumerism and just walk around and buy things.
Yeah.
And that's enough of a cultural memory, enough of a cultural implant, that it became a whole goddamn genre.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite genres too. So maybe I'm the consumerist whore deep down.
And that iconography, that sort of symbolism, because yeah, and specifically with Mallsoft, it's memories of music that, like, it was familiar enough in the way it was produced that it wasn't like, people weren't listening to this exact music, but it was still like, oh, I remember this, you know, because it still triggered those kind of memories. And the whole point of Mallsoft music is it's kind of like, if you look, focus in on it, just kind of blurs, you know, it just kind of, it's peripheral music. It's not music you're supposed to like do a deep attentive listen to.
Mm-hmm.
It's background ambient noise that is comforting. Yeah. So vaporwave is kind of like, I guess, trying to be an antidepressant, you know, in acoustic form in some ways. It's trying to alleviate our anxiety. You know, it's interesting. One thing that I'm always been interested in is not just the very obvious symbols of vaporwave, like you mentioned the Windows 95, various computers and video games, but there's a lot of symbols in vaporwave that are very absurd or surrealist, like this, the bust of Helios, the Greek bust.
Yes.
A lot of abstract conceptual art, a lot of palm trees kind of make sense, kind of, you know, emphasizing the dreaminess or the again, you're going to be safe. It's going to be great. You're just on vacation for the rest of your life. Looking at it from a hauntology lens, why do you think Helios has become such a prominent? Was it just because it was thrown on floral shops, you know, Macintosh Plus albums, cover art? Or
I have to imagine, and then that was so many people's, I don't know, has it been absorbed into, are we haunted by the spirit of Vectroid now? Because you put Helios on an album and now we just see it everywhere. I don't know. Has Vectroid ever talked about why, like what led to that album design?
No, I mean, I haven't asked. You know, Vectroid, she does stream on Twitch. I should probably join in on and just ask her in chat, see if she responds, or just Google some interviews. That's an interesting question for the future. But now that I think about it, maybe these are kind of related to like textbooks covers, because there are a lot of textbooks from the late 90s, early 2000s that have a very abstract design, a lot of polygons.
Yeah, that's a really good call, actually, because there's a lot of educational material kind of aesthetic in vaporwave. I think that's where a lot of the laser crossed lines and color choices always remind me of like middle school yearbooks.
Yeah, exactly. Middle school yearbooks. Yeah, because it's safe. No one's going to get offended by it. So.
Yeah. And then the aesthetic, of course, also branches into how stuff is made, which I always think how medium is produced sort of dovetails into its meaning. So we can kind of discuss these in tandem. But of course, one of the defining aspects of vaporwave is samples. And samples, by the nature of their existence, are designed, unless they're really, really mutated, are designed to invoke memories. And I think I've talked about this on the Echo Jams episode, that I think the particular processing in vaporwave makes them feel more like songs stuck in your head.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's another aspect to it as well. And Mark Fisher kind of characterizes this as the crackle, but that in vaporwave, it's the distortion, the making it sound like it came from a VHS or a cassette tape, or just half broken speakers and a mall in the distance, in the case of Mallsoft. But there's always some sort of distortion. So it's always a lo-fi, grungy, high noise to signal ratio. A key element of hauntology is that is more authentic, more real than the crystal, pristine CD quality, perfectly studio engineered nature of like pop music today. Like, you know, any pop song you listen to now is going to be perfectly engineered. Just the vocals are going to be absolutely perfect. The nature of auto-tuning actually varies in terms of fads. Like music seems to be less auto-tuned than it was in like the early 2000s. But that's a whole different discussion. But I think the crackle and the loss distorting these samples is sort of a key key component to hauntological music, at least in terms of vaporwave. I don't know. Do you think it's all music that's sort of hauntological, or just kind of vaporwave and maybe...
I think in terms of the lo-fi aesthetic, I think that's unique to vaporwave and a handful of other subgenres, because I don't think that lo-fi aesthetic in the same way works its way into something like Vapor Trap.
Mm-hmm.
But Vapor Trap is still haunted by production techniques because, like we talked about in the episode, it's very, there's like a lot of 808 focus and older synth patches, older drum machines, still bringing back memories. But it's less distorted. So I think that would be like an example.
Yeah, that's a good example. Of course, I'm always reminded of the Brian Eno quote, and I think we've used this before on the podcast, but it's such a good thing. Whatever you find now weird, ugly, and uncomfortable and nasty about our new medium will surely become its signature. CD distortion, the jitteriness of digital video, the crap sound of 8-bit, all will be cherished and emulated as soon as they can be avoided. The sound of failure. So much of modern art is the sound of things going out of control, of a medium pushing to the limits and breaking apart. I think that's sort of a key aspect. He wasn't specifically talking about hauntology, but, you know, he's sort of one of the OGs of ambient music and certainly an important influence on vaporwave.
And I think when you're surrounded by it, it's going to work its way into all your thoughts. And I, like you said, we have used that quote, but I really, really love it. I like it because it makes me think a lot about what are some aesthetics of today that we preserve that'll move forward. So I imagine a song that's like vocal samples, but they're like Discord robot voices, like when the voice servers mess up or something. It'd be interesting to see the sort of like uniquely, because one thing in the vaporwave is that a lot of the distortions and issues are analog distortions. They come from having a physical tape that's played at the wrong speed or like a dirty head reader.
Yeah, it's just physical objects wearing down.
But digital distortion exists, but it's very different. Like if you've ever seen digital static on cable versus old analog ear static and stuff. So I'd be curious to see if some of these digital aesthetics of degradation beyond just like compression work their way into stuff in 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, no, that's true. I think we'll see that first in horror, like horror narratives of some kind, especially like a movie or a TV show. I think we're already getting that a little bit because back in the 90s, Nick Cage made a movie called 8mm, which is about like a very scary 8mm film, because film at that point was so old and removed that it was anachronistic and scary. But then like 10 years later, you have Ring, which is about a haunted VHS tape. Maybe 5 or 10 years after that, God, there were a couple of horror movies about people on webcams and Skype getting murdered by people.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so I think we'll see more of that as we go on. I mean, of course, we are already kind of seeing that folk genre of creepypasta, like Ben Drowned, Slender Man, and all these other things, sort of like taking current technology and making it creepy and haunted by supernatural elements, not by our past or our future that we never got.
Yeah, that's true. I guess some of it has worked its way into horror movies because, yeah, there was the whole one that, what was the one that was entirely just on like Skype and Facebook Messenger?
Yeah, that's the one I'm trying to think of. That was, it was like a slasher flick. It was, there were two or three.
Unfollow or Unfriend?
Oh, yeah, Unfriended. Yeah. so... eventually there'll be a good horror movie about that phenomenon, I imagine. Found footage is in itself a haunted genre because it's about like the unreliability of our, you know, recording equipment. We can't get a perfect picture of what's happening because the camera is not objective. It is subjective. Yeah. And going on, referring again back to Mark Fisher, haunting then can be construed as a failed mourning. It's about refusing to give up the ghost. So it's a failed mourning of like what we were promised, going back to the idea of like we were promised something better than what we got.
Yeah. So for me, I think this kind of dovetails back into sort of three things that I was thinking about that we sort of covered, but I'm just gonna explicitly ask you, Ross. So the first is, both in, you know, way back to Derrida and then through Fisher and stuff, there is a lot of discussion about disjointed connection to past and trying to evoke those. But I was wondering, has that sort of merged because we've become so media saturated that kind of remembering media is remembering the history of your past? Because a lot of historical elements are in vaporwave, like the dot-com bubble burst, the development of the internet, all this other stuff. It almost feels like the media has become the lens to view history instead of just being a historian. I don't know if that makes sense.
Actually, one key element both Derrida and Mark Fisher refer to is the quote from Hamlet, time is out of joint. And I think one of the reasons why hauntology, this idea, this theory is so prevalent, or like it helps explain vaporwave, is because we no longer have a clear sense of historical progress. Like, especially for Americans, we had this idea of America is, we're colonizing. We have our children would be better off than us. And we're going to defeat the Soviet Empire. We're going to defeat the Soviet Union, our great enemies. And so there's always been like this sort of in popular culture, this kind of clear narrative of like, we started here, we're going to end up here. But after the Soviet Union fell, that kind of unwound itself. We're just going to have late stage capitalism, which is not really as interested in providing a clear narrative for everyone involved. Things started unraveling, at least in terms of that sense of progress, that sense of history. I think you're right. I think there is sort of this idea of only understanding history and like our sense of where we are and where we've been through media rather than, reading real history and, rigorous academic study, which has never been super popular in America and is probably less popular now than it's ever been because we have people inventing entire, universes and mindsets that, well, with the internet, those kind of fringe ideologies have become so mainstream that it's never been easier to just take a bubble worldview and just be entirely ensconced in that bubble, if you're a flat earther, you could surround yourself with other flat earthers and just consume flat earther media and just ignore everything else, which you couldn't really do back before the internet in our current circumstances, I think, because you had to deal more with other people and, what was called the mainstream.
Yeah, absolutely. So then my other two sort of discussion points I'm going to combine into one because I realized one is sort of personal and leads into the other. So thinking a lot about kind of my response to vaporwave and this topic, I sort of realized that to me, a lot of repetitions in songs started to feel like that repetition in samples started to be sort of a mental repetition in terms of anticipation. Like, how many times have I thought, even just in the last 5 months, like, oh, this is when things will turn around. This is when things will get better. And you're kind of caught in that like melancholy of the past. And now I wonder, am I in some state of like meta nostalgia or some weird nostalgia because I'm less nostalgic for the way things were and more like nostalgic for being nostalgic of things being good and looking ahead?
Yeah.
So is there like a meta nostalgia for nostalgia?
Yeah, I think
have we tacked on too many terms?
No. For me, it's a little different. Like the way I perceive it is that I am nostalgic for a world in which I didn't have to worry so much about the world itself. My problems were personal, but the world wasn't going to end at any given moment or about to collapse or slowly collapsing in front of my eyes. Certainly, like I said earlier, in the 90s, you could kind of like ignore that. And yeah, I think again, from an American's perspective, 9/11 did change everybody's bubble and like realize, hey, history is still happening. We can't just worry about our own lives. Sometimes something bad will happen that we have no control over or that is just beyond us. That idea that like when I was growing up, like I just had to worry about like my own personal future. I wasn't like thinking, well, the world could collapse in my lifetime and society could collapse or who knows what will happen. I was pretty sure society and institutions and things were going to keep on keeping on. I think somewhere in the Mark Fisher books, he talks about how like people who are worried about certain things since the 70s or 80s are beginning to see them happen. So it's kind of, I think, related to that. So again, just we've been putting off major problems so long that now we're nostalgic for when we could just worry about our own personal alienation and isolation and late stage capitalism screwing us over on a personal level.
And also not just screwing me over, but screwing other people over because, I grew up in rural Western Maryland and didn't know about other people until I was like 18 and went to college.
Yeah.
And now, now I'm hyper aware because I have so many friends that I dearly love that are just constantly under assault nowadays. And it's just, it's a lot to process and think about. And
yeah,
it's torture to have even a shred of empathy in 2020.
I mean, think of Vaporwave really started taking shape in the aftermath of the great financial crisis of 2008.
Yeah.
Then really took hold after it became clear that Obama was not going to, you know, change anything. Like he was just going to be a status quo president. So you, on one sense, you like the Obama, I don't think Vaporwave would have happened without the Obama presidency, because on one hand, Obama was very much, everything's going to be normal, everything's going to be fine, the status quo. But if you had an ounce of awareness, you knew that things were, it was being papered over. Like our economy was kind of getting back, but it was never going to be like helping the normal people. And then, you know, the Republican Party is becoming just publicly fanatical, you know, in its hatred. And you have, you know, for example, manifesting in just weird racism, like the birther issue. Mm-hmm. Remember birtherism? And then, of course, their fanatical hatred of trying to give people health care through their opposition of the Obamacare, you know, the ACA. And so things were normal, but they weren't. And this sort of like, it's hard for anybody to kind of like express these mutually exclusive worldviews that things are okay and or things are definitely not okay. And Vaporwave is kind of the same thing. It's music that is normal, but it is not normal. Like it's the same thing that you've been listening to for decades, but it's beginning to break down. It's beginning to mutate. And so maybe that's the appeal of it, is that it's representing our inner land, our inner mindscape to some degree. It's the same kind of psychic stress of being pulled in two different directions at once.
Yeah.
Boy, that's depressing to think about. Hey, better listen to some Vaporwave.
What a way to go out. But man, that's where it's headed. And we'll have to see where Hauntology and sort of what cultural nostalgia does for us in 20 or 30 years and where we're at.
But for listeners out there, so Hauntology is, again, this theoretical framework. It's not necessary to appreciate or like Vaporwave. But if you kind of want to like think about where it comes from, like what the appeal is, why did a meme essentially linger on and like become this niche thing that's pretty stable and actually flourishing, I think. There's a lot of interesting Vaporwave still being made, a lot of really cool stuff, and which we will obviously review in the future. Yeah, so it helps you appreciate it, but it's not necessary. So if this was, I don't know, too deep or whatever for episode, let us know.
No, I think it's, even like I said earlier, just as a lens for media analysis, I think it's legitimately interesting, even if you want to leave Vaporwave pure in some sense so that you don't have to think about these things. So we'll leave some show notes with like books and articles if you want to dig even deeper than we could in 45 minutes or so.
Yeah, but like if you think about it, all music is a reflection of the time it was made in.
Yep.
And now that I think about it, Vaporwave is the perfect music for the Obama the Obama era.
It's pretty inspired.
Yeah, that or Hamilton.
Oh no.
I mean that maybe those are the two polar opposites. You have Hamilton on top and Vaporwave seething below, waiting to break out.
All right. Well, it's been a good run. 10 episodes.
I don't want to admit it, but like there have been, you know, fascists and right-wing people who have tried to co-opt Vaporwave and make, you know, Trump wave and fascist wave and that kind of thing. Why they use Vaporwave over Synthwave, although they probably use both, but like I only heard about the Vaporwave stuff, is because, again, it's a reflection of people wanting a future or people mourning a future that was supposed to be safe. And what is fascism is like people who are scared and want to be safe again, or are willing to hurt other people and to dehumanize other people in order to be safe. I mean, I think that's an appeal of it. So
exactly. And, you know, for a lot of people, their idealization of what was good about the past is unbelievably gross.
Yeah, exactly. It's something to think about. But listen to Vaporwave because you got to deal with that inner stress somehow. And what better way than listen to that mall music? But yeah, thanks for listening to this episode. You can find us at Night Clerk Radio on Twitter. I am at Ross Payton on Twitter. And
I am at Burke McBergenson. Next week, we're going to get back to just talking about two albums. So I think one of the pillar genres is dark ambient. So that's going to be the first one that we revisit in some sense. So we're going to be discussing two, I think, more recent dark ambient albums. Mm-hmm. One inspired by Lynch, my favorite.
And the other one is actually from The Caretaker, who is mentioned in Mark Fisher's book. But we're going to see The Caretaker's new work. And who is The Caretaker? Well, you'll have to listen to the next episode if you don't already know. So stay tuned to Night Clerk Radio.
Bye.